This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Division of the Arts and Humanities at the University of Chicago, offering an interdisciplinary Master of Arts program in humanities that provides individualized attention in a supporting community. The flexible curriculum allows students to focus coursework within a single department or engage with multiple disciplines, creating a uniquely tailored graduate degree. Applications now open for the April 30th deadline at humanities.uchicago.edu. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
This is not a perfect party. We are not a perfect people. Yet we are called to a perfect mission. Our mission to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to house the homeless, to teach the illiterate, to provide jobs for the jobless, and to choose the human race over the nuclear race.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Don't forget to keep listening all the way to the end of this episode to get a rundown of the big Chicago area stories of the day. But first, Reverend Jesse Jackson died on Tuesday. He was 84 years old. And Jackson showed that Black political candidates could get support in national elections. He inspired so many African Americans to not just dream, but to seek office and do. Joining me now is In the Loop senior producer, Sienna Greaves, who produced this segment. Hey, Sienna.
Hey, Sasha. How you doing?
I'm doing well. A little bit sad. I'm still kind of going down the rabbit hole because though it's been a day since Jackson died, I can't stop watching just old footage of just really inspirational moments in the 80s and 90s. Sure. And it's just bringing me back to my childhood and just, you know, seeing this powerful figure and just knowing that he was a symbol of hope. And there's a lot to discuss.
Absolutely.
Right. In this conversation. So I'm really glad that we did it. We're looking back at his incredible life and beyond his work, though, in civil rights in the 60s and his cultural and political legacy. I'm wondering what sticks out to you.
Well, definitely for me, it is that 1988 Keep Hope Alive speech.
Oh, yeah.
I was a wee lass and don't even think 10 years old yet, watching that with my parents. And he had that wonderful refrain of, I understand.
Yes.
I understand what it means to be poor. I understand what it means to grow up in a home with a single mother. And he's really connecting in those moments, not just to Black voters, people of color, but just everyone, anybody who dared to have ambitions beyond their own humble beginnings. And it was a really a standout moment for me that I'll never forget.
One of the standout moments for me in the conversation that we're about to play for folks is when Maudlin Ihajerica, who's a journalist here in Chicago, talks about the doors he opened for not just Black politicians, but also Black journalists, right? He was the one that was letting your story shine. At times, publications would sort of frown upon stories that had a Black storyline or central figure or narrative. And Jackson was the one to get Black reporters into the room and to give them the big stories that they could go back to their editors and say, here's what's really happening, and get our stories on front pages.
Yeah, absolutely. I think reflecting on Jesse Jackson's political career in the 1980s, we're also reflecting on America, right? And like you said, the 80s was a time where you didn't see a lot of Black political power. It was a time where, for journalists, you know, media was still largely segregated.
Yeah.
You didn't have Black stories on the front page. As you see Jackson's political fortunes rise, he's bringing Black journalists along for that journey. And we hear Alvin Tillery in this conversation say that he was the last great mobilizer. And
yeah,
that was something that really struck me.
Mobilizer of Black journalists, of Black people, of all people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's dive into that conversation. Thank you so much, Sienna.
Thank you, Sasha.
At the table, Maudlin Ihajerica, Field Foundation Director of Journalism and Storytelling, and former Chicago Sun-Times columnist. Alvin Tillery, who's a professor of political science at Northwestern University and a Democratic strategist and pollster. And in a few moments, we'll also hear from Ambassador Carol Mosley Braun, former U.S. Senator from Illinois. Now, a day after Jackson's death, I wanted to hear how all the panelists were feeling. Maudlin went first.
It felt like a punch in the gut, even though we knew it was coming. We knew it was a matter of time, but to hear that Jesse Jackson was no longer in the world was a feeling of immense loss for all that he represented, all that he fought for. It was very difficult.
Hmm. Professor?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, first, I want to say I had the privilege of sitting at the feet of Reverend Jackson as a young student activist. And, he was just a force of nature. And I just want to say, he is the last great liberal lion to pass. And it's a big loss. And I also want to give my condolences to the Jackson family.
Joining us now is Ambassador Carol Mosley Braun, former U.S. Senator from Illinois. Good morning to you. Welcome to In the Loop.
Good morning. I'm delighted to be here.
Good to see you again. I wonder how you are processing the news of the Reverend's passing today.
It's been really rough, although it wasn't unexpected. We all knew he was sick. You just never know when it's coming.
Yeah.
When it's happening. And so I was devastated, as was everybody else, to learn that he actually had passed yesterday morning. It's a wonderful run. He's got nothing to. He can be very proud looking down on the rest of us. Mm-hmm. He really could. He did it. He did everything he could to contribute to humanity, and he did that. And if you live that kind of a life, you got to be pleased when you close your eyes.
Yeah, he's looking down. He's probably smiling, mm-hmm. and he's at rest,
absolutely.
At peace.
Yep.
Finally at rest. When did you first meet the Reverend Ambassador, and what was your first impression?
I was basically a teenager. I was a young teenager. I was like 15 or so. And my mother worked over west. And so I would leave her at her job and go over to the first Operation Breadbasket, which was in a movie theater on Halsted. So I would go over there to volunteer as an usherette. And so I met him then. Mm. And so there I was carrying the little basket around, getting nickels and pennies and whatnot to try to raise money for then Operation Breadbasket.
Right. Wow. Professor, the Reverend ran his first presidential campaign in 1984. What was the journey like to that stage?
Oh, so Reverend Jackson really picked up the mantle from Fannie Lou Hamer and her, impressive challenging of the Democratic Party's very calcified, some would say segregationist establishment in the late 1960s. And so, what Reverend Jackson did was, his contribution was finishing the work of bringing Black people fully into the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. Making it possible for us to have representation, but more importantly, to change the rules.
What did the Democratic Party look like up until that time?
Oh, all white male, and was divided between two wings. There was the FDR wing, which was wanting to provide benefits to everyone in the country, regardless of race, and then there was the more powerful segregationist or Dixiecrat wing. And so, the 1964 and 68 conventions, we saw this rupture. And Reverend Jackson's work was stitching back a coalition that would bring Black people who really didn't begin voting until 1965, mm-hmm. until really 1968 was the first election that Black people were fully able to participate in.
Right.
And so what Reverend Jackson did is he said, we're here. And then he also made the party take note of us, and he worked very assiduously to change the rules for nominating presidents, mm-hmm. In a way that made Barack Obama president, later.
Later, yes. Mm-hmm. How, Maudlin, would you say his candidacy was received by Black Americans?
Jesse was a interesting figure. Before his very first campaign, he was beloved. he was beloved by Black Chicago and really widely respected across the nation because of who this man was. This man went to the mat with corporations, with government entities. He went to the mat on behalf of the marginalized and the disadvantaged, and he never backed down. So Black America knew him as this man who led these boycotts, who led the marches, who was always agitating, always advocating, and he was widely, widely respected. And that was before his 1984 campaign. Mm-hmm. Black Americans were very, very excited by his candidacy.
How did white Americans receive him, Professor? Mm-hmm.
With great hostility in some quarters, but not universally. I mean, I think what's really interesting is that the Rainbow Coalition is the foundation of modern white liberal democratic politics. And so Reverend Jackson's campaigns in 84 and 88 brought people into the national spotlight, like Bernie Sanders, like Paul Wellstone. And so we saw his campaigns really further highlight that there are people, there are white people in the country who were willing to follow a Black man. And that expansion of what was possible visually also helped Barack Obama later during his presidential runs.
And Ambassador, you volunteered on Jackson's 1988 campaign. What was the experience like for you?
Well, it was an active campaign. I had never been involved with a presidential campaign until then.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was really exciting, and I was learning every minute of every day. So it was wonderful. I met a lot of people that are still, some of whom I'm still friends with. I was happy to be there because I, being a girl, right? Mm-hmm. That was one of the other issues. You had to break through this male hierarchy. And they were very serious. It was like the preacher squad. They were very serious. And in fact, a friend of mine during that campaign, no, it was a later campaign, but we were sitting in church and in the front row. And of course, there were all the ministers sitting there. And then the choir was behind. And the choir was all female. The ministers were all male. And a friend of mine said, that's why Anita Hill has not caught on more in the Black community. Oh. And that person was right. Because there was this misogyny, this hierarchy that exacerbated misogyny. And women had, you know, you could do things like, you know, pack the boxes. But you couldn't have a voice to say anything about anything. Mm. And he changed that too. Even though he was not a feminist by any means. but having said that, he really opened doors for women to be in leadership positions and for marginalized people, as Professor Tillery says.
Yeah.
He's right. And that's exactly right. It didn't matter, it didn't matter what you looked like or who you were, you had a home. With him. Mm-hmm. And he opened the doors for so many different types of people and made us all part, you know, and that loses sight of the fact that at the end of the day, he really was a patriot. He believed in democracy. Mm-hmm. He believed in opening up democracy and making it work for everybody. Mm-hmm. And that was a unique message at the time.
Yeah.
And that's really how, you know, he caught on.
Yes.
Because he built this rainbow coalition. And it wasn't a rainbow of simply diverse races. It was also gender.
Yes.
For the first time, he opened the doors for women to become business owners. And that had never been done. Mm. So, you know, yes, he wasn't a feminist, but he knew how to open the tent and include everyone.
I want to play a little bit from Jesse Jackson. This is his 1988 speech, that Keep Hope Alive speech that we all know.
I wasn't born in the hospital. Mama didn't have insurance. I was born in the bed, at house. I really do understand. Born in a 3-room house, bathroom in the backyard, slop job by the bed, no hot and cold running water. I understand. Wallpaper used for decoration? No. For a windbreaker? I understand. I'm a working person's person. That's why I understand you, whether you're black or white. I understand work. I was not born with a silver spoon in my mouth. I had a shovel programmed for my hand. My mother, a working woman. Some of the days she went to work early, with runs in her stockings. She knew better, but she rolled runs in her stockings so that my brother and I could have matching socks and not be laughed at school.
Ambassador, I mean, we've seen videos of that very moving speech and Jackson's speech actually moving folks to tears. What was that moment like in real time?
He was able to galvanize people on an emotional level and a personal level in a way that, and that speech spoke about the fact that he was the embodiment of the American dream. He had come from humble roots and had risen to the point of running for president of the United States. And he was unabashed about that.
Mm-hmm.
And the good thing, and people responded to it because they saw their own stories in what he was talking about. And so it was a very uplifting, inspirational opportunity for me. I mean, I was a kid. I didn't know. I'm listening to this man talk about his own background and hearing in that I came from humble beginnings, but in America, I can run for president.
Yeah. What was the impact of that speech on you, Madeline?
I remember listening to that speech and crying. And, you know, for me, this was a man who was the first to bring the American dream to that national platform. Because prior to his candidacy, none of the candidates looked like me, sounded like they came from where I came from, or knew anything about who I was and my family's struggles. And so I could sit there, yes, as a middle-class journalist and listening to it, but I knew that I was an immigrant whose family came here with the American dream and clawed their way to get their children through college so that I could sit there and listen to this Black man say, I know your story. I am your story.
Yeah.
And this is America. And so, you know, for me, it was the most impactful speech I had ever heard up until then. And I could barely write because I was crying.
Wow. Memories for you, Professor, from hearing that speech?
Well, I was 13 years old the first time Reverend Jackson ran for president. And what I remember distinctively is my father, who had done two tours in Vietnam, taking a sort of a hammer and tacking his Jesse for President sign into the front yard of neighborhood that we had just integrated with great difficulty. And just the kind of boldness of that. And then I said, who is this Jesse Jackson person that's got my father's this very taciturn Virginian, you know, sort of excited? And I became a political scientist because of Reverend Jackson.
Wow.
I became an activist because of sitting at the feet at Reverend Jackson when he was trying to breathe new life into the student movement in the Atlanta University Center when I was a student at Morehouse College. And so for me, it's not academic, so to speak. It is I do what I do because of watching Reverend Jackson do what he did.
Why were his campaigns so impactful, Professor? I mean, and he even impacted the minority voter participation, too. What was it?
Jesse Jackson is the last of the great mobilizers, mm-hmm. right? So if we think about the dilemma in Black politics now is that the baby boomer generation is passing on. The mm-hmm. baby boomers are the greatest citizens in the history of the American Republic. They way overperform their education level, their income level. They turn out, they bring others to the polls. Now we're moving to millennials and Gen Zers who we don't know how to mobilize. Jesse Jackson is the last civil rights figure coming between Dr. King, after Dr. King, after, you know, Fannie Lou Hamer, John, who could mobilize the community. And so now, you know, the energy that he brought, winning 13 primaries, 7 million votes, that showed the Democratic Party who their base was. And the dilemma is not everyone in the party was comfortable with that, right? And so we've got to get back to a situation where we can figure out how to capture the energy that he brought to the stage.
And Madeline, he used the media, too, to garner support, didn't he?
Absolutely. Jesse was nothing if not charismatic and charming. Jesse could put you off. You could come to him with a tough angle, with a tough story, and be ready to hold him to account. And Jesse would just disarm you with his realness, with his just, you know, owning up to who he was, to his flaws, but saying, but I am doing the right thing. Mm. And you had to give him that. You had to give him that so that no matter what you were trying to hold him to account on, you had to give him that he was doing the right thing for the marginalized, the disadvantaged, demanding equity for gender equity, racial equity. And he was doing the right thing. So your stories were always balanced when you were dealing with Jesse because the brilliant and the famous are often complicated figures.
Yes.
And so you had to take him with a grain of salt and give him his due.
Yeah. Well, I want to hear from all three of you here. Tell me the single moment of Jesse Jackson's life that you think you're going to always reflect on. Mm-hmm. Ambassador, what comes to mind for you? What's that one thing that you will always remember
down
about?
Down with dope, up with hope.
One more time.
Down with dope, up with hope.
Down with dope, up with hope. Yeah, he was one for the one-liners, wasn't he?
He was very charming, too. And that's what Madeline was getting at. He was so charming. He was so smart. And he used his brilliance and his charm to really kind of get around being straightforward or answering the hard questions. Mm-hmm. He would just disarm you right off the bat. And he was a brilliant man, and I think the brilliant patriot, and I think that should not be lost in all these celebrations and accolades he's getting now.
Yeah. The image of Jesse Jackson for me just kind of, when I think of like the 1988 speech, that image of him at the podium, it's just frozen in time for me. And so I just remember I was a child. I remember hearing that speech. No idea who he was at the time. I was very young. But I just, that image of him just kind of stuck with me. And it made me feel good. Made me feel like something good was happening. Mm-hmm. Didn't know what it was. Couldn't put my finger on it. But something was changing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What's the moment for you that you'll always remember, Maudlin?
You know, as a journalist, I have to say that he was good to me. As a Black journalist in Chicago, Jesse was good to Black journalists because we always had to fight for our place in the newsroom. And Jesse was very intentional about making sure he gave Black journalists the story before anyone else. He knew the inequities that we dealt with. And so he respected us. And so for me, what I will always remember is that as a rookie reporter in the early 90s, I was assigned, of course, I was working weekends, you know, you're low man on a totem pole. Every Saturday morning, I had to traipse over to Operation Push and listen to what they had to say for 2 hours, come back and propose a story that often would get, we won't take a story today. But I got to know Jesse, and Jesse got to know me, and he took me under his wings, and he started feeding me the big stories. Mm. And suddenly, I would return on Saturdays with stories where my bosses would be like, oh my God, let's put that on the front page Sunday, right? So that's who Jesse was for me. I will always remember that he looked out for young Black journalists and Black journalists in general.
What a great story. Professor, leave us with your single most important memory of his life.
So Grant Park, 2008, when Barack Obama was elected and he's sobbing, you know, and so here it is. Jesse Jackson's activism, his reform of the Democratic Party, made Barack Obama's presidency possible.
Yes.
You know, the Democratic Party moved to the right well before Barack Obama. He had to run out of a tradition not necessarily aligned with what Reverend Jackson tried to put in place for all of us. And yet Reverend Jackson, with no bitterness, you know, he wasn't really embraced by those campaigns in the way that he should have been. He is still there sobbing like a baby because a Black man completed the mission. And I looked up and my father and my grandfather were sobbing too. And I will never forget that moment.
And let us all agree, there is no Barack Obama without Jesse Jackson.
Yeah.
There is no President Barack Obama without the candidacy of Jesse Jackson.
Absolutely.
Alvin Tillery is a professor of political science and director of the Center for the Study of Diversity and Democracy at Northwestern University. Madeline Ihajerica is Field Foundation Director of Journalism and Storytelling, and Ambassador Carol Mosley Braun is former U.S. Senator from Illinois. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
Now let's turn to some of the biggest local stories of the day. At the table to help us out was Claire Lane, WBEZ's Morning Edition anchor, and Meha Ahmed, In the Loop's senior producer. Claire kicked things off with a rundown of local reaction that we've been hearing about the loss of Reverend Jesse Jackson.
So many people speaking up and speaking out about Reverend Jackson's influence on them, influence on Chicago, influence on the country. WBEZ reporters yesterday talking with his daughter, Santita, talking with folks on the street in Mariano's parking lot.
Yes.
Governor J.B. Pritzker, Barack Obama, of course, and even in a post on Truth Social, President Trump calling Jackson a good man with grit and, quote, street smarts. So we even heard from the president on this. Sun-Times columnist Lee Bay this morning on Morning Edition, I don't know if you heard, reflecting on Jackson's influence as a cultural sort of sensation as well, his SNL appearances. So just so much, so many people coming
out
of the woodwork.
Not just the civil rights work. It was just, he was just such a well-rounded gentleman, right? We know that the family is now talking. They're speaking. They've got a press conference going right now, the Jackson family, talking about their father, of course, and flags all around, flying at half mast. I want to play a little bit of how Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson told WBEZ he would remember the Reverend just a few months ago.
What I try to do now is just, you know, relish the moments that we've had together. You know, things like when he would say to me, you know, Brandon, you have to say it as if it's the first time they've ever heard it, you know, and that you got to keep hope alive. And, you know, he just has such a keen strategic mind. And that's something that, you know, I will always cherish.
In other news, Meha, apparently there's a fire watch warning. What's that?
Yeah, the National Weather Service is warning of high fire danger today across a lot of northern Illinois. That includes Cook County, the Chicago area, Lake, DeKalb, DuPage counties. And there are really three things to blame here. It's unseasonably warm. There's low relative humidity and strong winds. Together, these things do not make for the best of bedfellows. So there's, I mean, the winds, I think, can reach up to 40 miles per hour. I mean, we know it's going to be 66 degrees today. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's also dry vegetation out there. Fires can...
Yeah, so this is why when I stepped out this morning, my car was full of muddy-looking water.
Mm-hmm.
That's
exactly
correct.
And
it was a muddy mess after I just washed her on Sunday.
Very, very windy.
I was... flabbergasted.
You got to keep the Windex in your trunk, Sasha.
No,
you should know this by now.
Got in and hit drive.
So what that means for everybody else is that they are urged not to start open fires outdoors because they can get out of control really quickly. And if you're somebody who throws a cigarette out the car window, maybe don't do that.
Yeah.
Because, you don't want to throw any matches or cigarettes out of moving vehicles. They can, again, start fires.
Wicked, wicked wind out there. Is this warm weather sticking around, though, Claire?
No, sadly.
Oh, boy.
Well, that's why us in the Midwest like to call it a fall spring.
Yeah.
Temperatures tonight going to take a bit of a dip. We're going to be in the 30s. Hate to say it, by Friday yet again.
Are you listening, daughter? She said the temperatures are going to dip.
Don't put
this
coat away.
This child left the house this morning with no coat. and thought I was crazy.
Absorb the vitamin D. It is going to be sunny today, so just soak that in like a little solar panel, and hopefully that'll keep you through the next couple of days.
Those of us who know better know never to put your coat away. You wait till like May to put the coat away.
Exactly. Today is a big day for the state. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker is delivering his annual budget address. It's happening at noon, Claire. What can we expect?
Yeah, this is his annual chance to address the state, talking about some of the dire straits of our finances. As we know, the two-term Democrat, he's going to outline how Illinois will spend and generate our money amid a lot of uncertainty. We've been covering this on WBEZ and the Sun-Times over the stability of federal funding. Illinois' economic forecasters projecting some growing deficits in the next couple of years, largely due to the Trump administration's tariff policies and lots of cuts, as we've seen, to social services. Mm-hmm. Pritzker running for a historic third term. He's also mulling, as we know, a 2028 presidential election. He's been one of Trump's loudest critics, so expect some commentary on that as well.
Is he mulling that 2028 presidential election? I feel like he hasn't quite given us a straight answer on that.
All we know is that he's slimming down. He's getting in control of his weight. His hair is free-flowing right now. He's looking like he's changing his look a little bit, maybe to have a little bit more broad appeal.
He likes doing those national interviews on national outlets.
That is true. Yep. That is true. So those are some of his priorities there, Claire, that he's looking to fix in this proposed budget.
Focusing on affordability, for sure. As we know, back in October, Governor's Office of Management and Budget estimated a $2.2 billion deficit for the new fiscal year. So we're going to see how we can sort of set up to balance that budget.
Mm-hmm. Now, Meha, you are our resident sports fanatic here on the team. I want to make sure that everyone knows that. So you've got Chicago Bears news for us. Tell us what's going to happen here.
I mean, I can see the sarcasm more than I can hear it from you. Yes. So the Chicago Bears, listen, it's going to cost a little bit more to be a fan because they are raising their season ticket prices by more than 13% next season. Team president and CEO Kevin Warren announced the price hike for the 2026 season in a letter to season ticket holders. The Sun-Times says the increase wasn't a total shock to fans, or I should say it shouldn't be a total shock to fans, because the team has raised their season ticket prices by at least 8%. I think last season it was 10%.
Is that what happens when a team starts to get better? You start to have to pay more to see them
play?
Well,
you could argue that. Certainly we've seen that with the Cubs over the last couple of seasons. But the last 2 years, the Bears weren't that good. So I think that they're really doubling down, because this past season,
They were really good. So is there an official reason about the why?
Yes. Warren said that, you know, he cited the dramatic turnaround, a playoff win, and, you know, quote unquote, market research as to why the prices are going up. So essentially, the team just did too well.
I knew it.
They are betting that fans will pay more for their seats.
I had a feeling.
Well, it could be one of the last seasons at Soldier Field. We don't know that for sure.
Oh, okay.
But that could be something, another draw for fans. People, while they can still see the Bears in Chicago, might
on
as
the
well
lake
charge.
Front.
That's right.
Yeah,
Indiana's got its eye.
It's Arlington Heights, baby. What other stories are you watching, Claire?
Speaking of the Burbs, Chicago area getting its third IKEA.
Yay!
Yeah, so this, we've
more
got
hot dogs.
We have more hot dogs, more Swedish meatballs, more budget furniture. But it really is such an experience to go to these stores. The ones in Bolingbrook and Schaumburg are huge. They occupy so much land. So this one at Gurney Mill, set to open in the fall, will offer the same sorts of goods, furnishings, accessories. But it's only going to be 66,000 square feet.
Oh, that's
it? So it'll be Illinois' smallest IKEA.
So tiny.
We'll see.
They
got to make ample room for the cafeteria. It's
trying to
like.
Imagine how big that is.
Yeah.
Sounds big.
You'll have to head to Gurney.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sienna Greaves, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.